Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaki on Culture and Race, Part 9. You know, I'd like to return to something that I've talked about twice before already, which is Yaki's surprise and my surprise at Yaki being surprised about what he called the crisis of the Western civilization. And he summed it up in this one sentence here where he said, "The proud civilization which in 1900 was master of 18/20 of the Earth's surface arrived at a point in 1945 after the suicidal Second World War where it controlled no part whatever of the Earth." I want to reiterate that because I think it really is, in a nutshell, what the problem with Yaki's analysis is. As educated, as knowledgeable, as intelligent as Yaki was, and I think his heart was in the right place too, he made the fundamental error of seeing the civilization which had and what it accomplished by 1900 as being European. And he couldn't understand why within 50 years it had turned around 180 degrees and suddenly the white man owned nothing. And I give him credit for, in the wake of the war, seeing that what so many other people didn't see clearly for decades beyond, what many people today won't even admit. But he didn't see that even by 1900, really, the white man, the European man, had already lost control of his own civilization to the Jews. The real cause of the crisis of Western civilization is the Jews. And they are perfectly conscious of their own identity, separate and apart from Europeans, their own interests as a people, not as some amorphous, capitalized idea or civilization. They call themselves and think of themselves as a people. And though they had possessed political power, considerable political power at various times, going as far back in recorded history as you care to go, at least in my experience, they had never really consolidated it like they had during the 19th century. And that's really when it came to a head in Europe. And when their struggle to take direct control over the Western civilization really was won in the 19th century. It was actively resisted up until the middle part of the 20th century in World War II. That was really what it was about. Germany had recognized it and resisted it actively by force of arms. But since that war, Jewish rule has not been challenged, and it hasn't even been seriously questioned. It's taboo to even speak of it. And that's what's really odd, is today it's less acceptable and less common to hear about Jewish rule, even though their rule is more firm and more established, more powerful today than it was in 1900. Now, a few weeks ago, I published a rather lengthy article. I described it as an addendum to this examination of Yaki that I've been working on for weeks now, this long examination of Yaki. And it was basically Revelo Oliver's opinion and critique of Yaki. And he essentially comes to the same conclusions or makes the same similar criticisms to mine. But a couple of important things, the highlights I'd like to pull out here and emphasize. beyond just making reference to it, pointing it to you to it. It's a lengthy read. But Oliver writes, if there is a dominant characteristic of our civilization, it is the capacity, in good minds, for rigorously objective observation of nature and strictly rational inferences and deductions therefrom. The mentality which has made possible our science and technology. A little further on, he writes, if we look for this rational view of the world in other civilizations, we find no trace of it. So this is what Oliver saw as distinctive of our race, is this objective observation of nature, rational inferences, science and technology. And Yaki doesn't really deny this, but he actually identifies the problem as rationalism. One facet of the problem, materialism, is another facet related to rationalism in Yaki's mind. That's what he blames. He doesn't blame the Jews, a separate group of people who have their own interests and who are working towards their own interests that are at odds with Europeans. Instead, Yaki blamed these amorphous conceptual things as if they had a life and a will of their own. Now, Oliver wrote a little bit more here about Yaki and Spengler's misunderstanding of race. He writes, this attempt to minimize the biological nature of men is paradoxical in writers who not only recognize that the greater part of human conduct is determined by instincts and tropisms that are largely subconscious, but so restrict the function of reason as to make it virtually without effect on the course of history. We are told, and the proposition is illustrated by examples drawn from the history of our race, that great men who determine events rather than chatter or write about them, like all of us, have a tact or an instinct that enables them to make correct decisions with so little reliance on their rational powers that they may not know why they took the action that made them victorious or successful in a given undertaking. Their strength comes not from superior powers of cognition and cogitation, but from a faith in their own destiny. The psychological problem cannot be analyzed here, but if we accept the claim that even the greatest men are basically irrational, we thereby attribute to heredity an absolute power over human conduct, of which it becomes the sole determinant, since it is beyond question that in all mammals, including men, instincts are innate and genetically transmitted. The logical conclusion to be drawn from Spengler's psychology, therefore, and Yaki's indirectly, I would say, is that biological race is supremely important. Granting that the race one feels is oneself, unquote, is what counts. What one feels, as distinct from what one may simulate, is genetically determined. Oliver is not entirely clear there, crystal clear, but basically what he's arguing is that this idea that of Yaki and Spengler's, that great men are great because they're driven by irrational instincts. Oliver is pointing out that these irrational instincts are themselves heritable traits. They're racial. In other words, it's an argument in support of the importance of biological race. Oliver went further and discussed Spengler's total misunderstanding of the Jews and Yaki's slightly better but still shallow understanding of the Jews. Spengler asked his readers to believe that the Jews are a dwindling and disintegrating people, a negligible force in world politics and the struggle for power. I have always thought the Jews' aspersions of Spengler's memory a good example of their habitual ingratitude toward their most effective apologists. Yaki, educated by events that Spengler did not live to see, and there he's referring only to World War II and the Nuremberg trials, because Spengler lived right up until almost the start of the war, or thereabouts. He was writing right up until that time, after the National Socialists came to power. Yaki, educated by these events, regards the Jews as the dominant force in the world of 1952. He has very little to say, however, about their unvarying activity through all the centuries since they first appear in history, and he focuses his attention entirely on the present. And this is something that I didn't realize myself until I really started to dig into Yaki, the significance of that. And that's what I'm focusing on in this installment here is just what is it, what are the consequences of this mistaken understanding of Jews, this shallow understanding, that to face the reality, as Yaki did, of what they were at the current time, but not to think back to what the influence was in the past that he was talking about. So much of what he writes is a review of the history of Europe. And at many points in this series, I've tried to point out where Yaki was missing the influence and the role that Jews were playing. Now, just the last time, in part 8, I read a section where he, as typical, described from Cromwell to Joseph Chamberlain the beginning and the end of that high political tradition which built the great British Empire. And he goes on to describe it as controlling 17/20 of the surface of the earth. So it's connected to what I started out reading, his the crisis of Western civilization, this dramatic change from controlling so much of the earth to not controlling it at all. Really, you see here what he's missing. He's missing the fact that during that great empire, from Cromwell, the Jews come back into England. And I'd like to detail now their takeover of that empire, and that by 1900, it was really their empire, and it went to war on their whim to protect their interests. Andrew Joyce wrote a two-part series titled Free to Cheat, Jewish Emancipation and the Anglo-Jewish Cousinhood, back in 2012, published at the Occidental Observer. He describes the cousinhood. The cousinhood was this Anglo-Jewish elite. From the early 19th century until the First World War, English Jewry was ruled by a tightly connected oligarchy. This Anglo-Jewish elite comprised some 20 interrelated Ashkenazi and Sephardic families, including the houses of Goldsmith, Montague, Nathan, Cohen, Isaacs, Abramson, Samuel, and Montefiore. At its head stood the House of Rothschild. This network of families had an exceptionally high degree of consanguinity, cousin marriage, intermarriage amongst themselves, leading to it being called the cousinhood. And among them, conversion and intermarriage with non-Jews was rare. A little later on, from Joyce's writing, by the mid-1830s, English Jews, led by the cousinhood, began to press for the removal of Christian oaths in the parliament, and this for their ability to enter the legislature. In other words, they were already, by the mid-1830s, trying to openly get into government. They had already had influence on the government, this from the early 19th century. But by the mid-1830s, they were actively trying to get into government itself to actually be the ones calling the shots. In 1858, Benjamin Disraeli, who is described by Joyce as a damp Jew, became leader of the House of Commons and removed its Christian oath restriction. That was the first thing he did, among the first things he did that first year. And by 1874, Disraeli was Prime Minister of Britain. In part two, Joyce writes, by 1899, Britain found itself at war with the Boers. And we talked about this in part eight last time, and I really just jumped over it. I provided some details in writing, but in speaking about it, I didn't. I want to address it in more detail here. A war with the Boers of the Transvaal over the vague cause of securing political rights for the foreign gold miners. Because of the obvious shared ethnic heritage of the mine owners and the diplomats who trod the path to war, the view that the war was a Jewish war was commonplace among its opponents. This opinion was reinforced by the fact that one of the conflict's earliest supporters was J. H. Hertz, the chief rabbi in South Africa. Hertz would later become would later be rewarded for beating the war drum with an appointment to no less a position than chief rabbi of the British Empire. In February 1900, members of Parliament were openly acknowledging the Jewish complexion of the hostilities, with John Burns emphatically declaring before a full House of Commons that wherever we examine, there is a financial Jew operating, directing and inspiring the agonies that have led to this war. The British Army, which used to be good, used for all good causes, has become the janissary of the Jews. That's an amazing statement. That was 114 years ago. You would never hear such a thing today, and yet, as Joyce points out, this is exactly the sort of thing that's being done now with the United States military. American armed forces, American men being used as tools for Israel. Joyce continues, the same year, the Trades Union Congress issued a statement that the war was being fought, this is the Boer War, to quote, secure the gold fields of South Africa for cosmopolitan Jews who have no patriotism and no country, unquote. So this is to Yaki's oversight, Yaki's neglect in not realizing, not mentioning that the Jews had already established enough control over Britain, despite their tiny numbers, despite their relative invisibility. They were able to send British men off to die for their interests. Yaki, in our series on Yaki's views on liberalism, he describes this, the laws of totality and sovereignty of political organisms. And this goes to the law of sovereignty, where if a political organism is not actually sovereign, is not actually ruled by an elite which has the interests of the political organism itself, in its entirety, at heart, well, it's not a healthy political organism. And Yaki was describing this British Empire as the height of political organisms, of Western civilization, as an exemplar. And he was wrong. It was by its end, from the beginning, you see the Jewish influence that Cromwell let in, and by the end, it was owned by the Jews and run by the Jews and danced to their tune. The law of sovereignty, just to remind and recall, is the inner necessity of organic existence, which places the decision in every important juncture with the organism, as opposed to allowing any group within to make the decision. And so it's really this lack of recognition of this group within that I am criticizing Yaki for, in not seeing the Jews not only really as an organism within, as a group within, but as a hostile group within, with its own interests, and seeing the greater organism, the European organism in which it is embedded, as a resource to be exploited, as an enemy to be used and exploited. And that Europeans, that the great flaw throughout European history, and even Yaki's review of it, Yaki himself, but also the people that he mentions, time and time again, we see that it's if Europeans have a problem, a flaw, it's in not seeing the Jew, not seeing, and for those who do see the Jew, that they don't see the Jew for what the Jew is and for what they are doing. They underestimate the Jews. And Yaki was guilty of that as well. So back to Adolf Hitler and, who Yaki referred to as the hero of World War II. And a little more picking up back where we left off the last time, reading from Mein Kampf in chapter 11 of volume 1, what Hitler titled Nation and Race. All the great civilizations of the past became decadent because the originally creative race died out as a result of contamination of the blood. The most profound cause of such a decline is to be found in the fact that the people ignored the principle that all culture depends on men and not the reverse. This is the exact opposite of, by the way, of what Yaqui believed and described. And that's why this is so odd that Hitler, his hero, he deviated from on this crucial issue, which Hitler himself identified as the cause of such racial contamination of the blood and the decline, ultimately, of any culture, any civilization. In other words, Hitler continues, in order to preserve a certain culture, the type of manhood that creates such a culture must be preserved. But such a preservation goes hand in hand with the inexorable law that it is the strongest and the best who must triumph, and that they have the right to endure. He who would live must fight. He who does not wish to fight in this world, where permanent struggle is the law of life, has not the right to exist. A little further on, Hitler continues, it would be futile to attempt to discuss the question as to what race or races were the original standard bearers of human culture, and were thereby the real founders of all that we understand by the word humanity. It is much simpler to deal with the question insofar as it relates to the present time. Here, the answer is simple and clear. Every manifestation of human culture, every product of art, science, and technical skill, which we see before our eyes today, is almost exclusively the product of the Aryan creative power. This very fact fully justifies the conclusion that it was the Aryan alone who founded a superior type of humanity. Therefore, he represents the archetype of what we understand by the term man. He is the Prometheus of mankind, from whose shining brow the divine spark of genius has at all times flashed forth, always kindling anew that fire which, in the form of knowledge, illuminated the dark night by drawing aside the veil of mystery and thus showing man how to rise and become master over all other beings on the earth. Should he be forced to disappear, a profound darkness will descend on the earth. Within a few thousand years, human culture will vanish and the world will become a desert. If we divide mankind into three categories, founders of culture, bearers of culture, and destroyers of culture, the Aryan alone can be considered as representing the first category. It was he who laid the groundwork and erected the walls of every great structure in human culture. Only the shape and color of such structures are to be attributed to the individual characteristics of the various nations. It is the Aryan who has furnished the great building stones and plans for the edifices of all human progress. Only the way in which these plans have been executed is to be attributed to the qualities of each individual race. He goes on then to explain his understanding of how Aryans conquered and subjugated other peoples and eventually mixed with them and thus disappeared. This is all the standard understanding that was worked out of European racial history from at least the time of Arthur Gobineau, 1850s inequality of human races that I mentioned the last time, all the way through to it was forcibly eradicated by the Jews who directed the Soviet, directed France and Britain, directed the United States to war on and destroy National Socialist Germany. There were other peoples and other interests involved, of course, but that really was the main struggle, and especially in retrospect, we can see that World War II, the white race lost, the entirety of the white race lost World War II, whether they participated in it or not, and the Jews won that war. Now, continuing with Yaqui from page 273 of his Imperium, in the section that he titles Race, People, Nation, and State, so very similar to the subject that Hitler is talking about, that we just read, although Hitler was writing 25 years earlier. Yaqui here has the benefit of 25 odd years of more further knowledge, further understanding of race and the Jews, and yet he fails utterly to accept the facts. He writes, the 19th century concepts of race, people, nation, and state are exclusively of rationalistic-romantic provenance. They are the result of imposing a thought method adapted to material problems onto living things, and thus they are materialistic. Materialistic means shallow as applied to living things. For with all life, the spirit is primary, and the material is the mere vehicle of spiritual expression. Again, that's an example, that last sentence there. The spirit is primary, and the material is mere vehicle of spiritual expression, is in direct conflict with reality. It's in direct conflict of what Adolf Hitler, his hero, said 25 years earlier, that it's actually man that comes first, and the spirit flows from man, the culture flows from man. And the people who forget that ultimately are destroyed by their neglect. Yaki continues, since these 19th century concepts were rationalistic, they were basically unfactual, for life is irrational, unamenable to inorganic logic and systematization. The age upon which we are entering, and of which this is a formulation, is an age of politics, and hence an age of facts. The broader subject is the adaptation, health, and pathology of high cultures. Their relationship to every type of human grouping is a prerequisite to examining the last problems of cultural vitalism. The nature of these groupings will therefore be looked at without preconceptions, with a view toward to reaching their deepest meanings, origin, life, and interconnections. Well, this all sounds very good if you don't see that Yaki didn't actually pay attention to the facts, overlooked the fact that the political organism, the Western civilization that he cared about so much, was already unhealthy by 1900, when he was saying that it had Western man or Western civilization had conquered 18/20 of the Earth's surface. It really wasn't the property of Western civilization. It was the property of the Jews. And that's why it was able to change so radically within only 50 years. The Jews had won their war and secured their ownership. Instead of confronting the facts about Jews and race, that the Jews are racially distinct, that they possess their own identity, that they pursue their own agenda, that they have a long-established pattern of infiltrating, manipulating, and exploiting hosts, not just in Europe, but long before. Yaki denied all of this and instead imagined that the problem was materialism and rationalism, driven by unexplained forces toward unexplained ends for unexplained reasons. He never describes what drives this materialism, this rationalism. It just is. And that's what's so unsatisfactory of in his explanation of what's important and how things work. His historiography, as Revelo Oliver called it, Yaki fails to actually acknowledge the facts. While he's asserting that he is being factual, he's talking about organics. He's not. He's talking about ideology, and his ideology is actually wrong.